Hi everyone, you're listening to Beyond the Benchmark, the EFT podcast. My name is Mo Zafzal, I'm the Global Chief Investment Officer for EFG. So today we have James Pomeroy, who's a senior global economist at HSBC. James, welcome back.
Thank you very much for having me. Absolute pleasure as always.
So I was just trying to figure out the last time you were on the podcast. It must be like a year or so.
I think it was about that long ago, yeah.
But no, great to have you. So one of the topics, or the most important topic for this podcast today, was doing a bit of a deep dive on the demographic situation around the world. It's actually one of my pet topics, actually. And it really started from a few books I read probably about 20 or 25 years ago, predicting the end of civilization. And I think my deputy CIO Dan Murray always quotes that the population of Japan in 1,000 years will be zero or one or something like that. But because if you run the stats that far, so anyway. Mathematicians and demographics actually work quite well together.
Oh, 100%. It's sort of the exponential decline of the world's population when you get birth rates where they are today. It becomes quite some of those numbers can be quite striking quite quickly.
You know, exactly. Certainly at the beginning of the year, one stat we were quoting, and maybe this is where we kick off, is on China, where we know that the one child policy has led to a particularly difficult demographic time bomb. Roughly 650 million people in population decline in China by the end of this century, which is the equivalent to Latin America. So pretty big numbers. What are your thoughts around, say, maybe China specifically, and some of the underlying trends that are driving some of these numbers?
Yeah, so China's a really interesting one. It's the one that probably gets the most attention in terms of global demographics. It was the world's largest population economy, and having a shrinking population is therefore a big deal. But it's a story that is replicated across the world. But the Chinese example is particularly interesting, as you mentioned, because of that one-child policy. And we're seeing at the moment, I guess, the second round impacts of that. So because you've had a lower birth rate for an extended period of time, you now have many fewer women in their sort of 20s and 30s who would be of childbearing age. So you're seeing almost this second round effect of that on the birth rate in China. And that's pulled that birth rate down to about just above one child per woman. And that's quite a low number. When you think about demographics, you always have to think about fertility rates relative to the 2.1, the number that is the replacement rate, the number of children per woman that keeps your population steady. So if you have a birth rate that's close to one, you're talking about a halving of your population over the course of a generation, which is how you get this enormous collapse in the population through the course of this century. And that's happening for a number of different reasons, but the reason that's held up the most is cost. And essentially, you've got young people in China who have moved into very expensive cities, particularly in terms of housing, and they often live in small one-bedroom apartments. And the cost of getting a second bedroom or a third bedroom or having a home where they could easily raise a family is very, very difficult. And we can discuss during the course of this podcast, that's a challenge we're seeing across the world, but it's playing a key role in China, where you've had this big move of people into cities over the course of the last few decades. And so that's a huge challenge. That affordability is becoming a problem. You're also seeing some of the same elements we've seen across the rest of the world, where there's an attitude towards having a family that has changed. A lot of young people today want to do other things rather than and raise a family. And so people want to go and see the world. They want to live a life of leisure to a degree, particularly when you're in your 20s and 30s. And so you're seeing people choose to have children later. There's fewer people to have children because of that sort of second round impact and that affordability question. You stack all that together, you get a very low birth rate. And it's one that becomes very, very hard to turn around because those second round effects get deeper and deeper and deeper. And so to get that birth rate to really notably pick up is going to be very, very difficult.
So just go back on China, and as you talked about sort of that roughly one child per woman, I guess you also had the second order impact is particularly in a more old-fashioned society such as China, where the focus was on males rather than females. So you've probably got less women as well as that one child. So most of those one child would be male.
That's it. It sort of amplifies. So you end up having this situation where the number of women of childbearing age in China is much, much lower than it was in the past. So even if each of those people are having two children or three children, your birth rate is still going to be lower. So you add on top of that these other issues around affordability and so on, and it accelerates that decline. And the numbers are really striking. You look at the number of births in China last year, it fell by more than 5% in a single year. Now, that's a very, very sharp drop, much more quick than I think a lot of people were expecting. And if you're starting to get to numbers that are births dropping by 2, 3, 4% a year, that's at a birth rate of one today. That number's only going to go lower. And actually, it's a similar story across the rest of the world. But policymakers want these numbers to go higher because they're so low. But if anything, you could argue they're more likely to go lower in the coming years. And so the demographic challenges become even more intense in the rest of this century.
So the obvious things we've seen, for example, in Japan, that maybe is a little bit more advanced than others, you typically see people working for longer, you know, and then obviously in Japan, women went back into the workforce. You saw all of those kind of sub-trends that are coming as a result of that, those population declines. You see similar thing in China and other places?
I think you will. I think the challenge for China is its sort of structure of its economy is in a very, very different place to other parts of the world that have seen rapid aging of the population. So in China, you still have a decent number of people, a decent share of the population employed in physical labor. So be that in manufacturing or agriculture compared to, say, a Japan over the last 20 years or European economies that have got similarly challenging demographics today. And that creates a real issue for China. And it means actually one area where you could see a solution here is rapid automation. And I think that's a trend that comes very, very quickly in the Chinese sense. And it's trying to replace those people with still being able to produce goods and be that in the agricultural sector or in manufacturing, it's going to require a very, very quick automation rollout across Chinese industry. And that's a sort of second trend that we think comes on the back of this is that change there. You could also see people working longer as well. You could see that same sort of story coming through in services jobs. It could also mean you see more of an acceleration in the transition of the Chinese economy away from physical labor and into more sort of service heavy jobs that people can do much more readily when they're in their 50s, 60s, 70s, rather than physical labor that becomes much more hard as you get older. So I think the demographic story is really interesting, not just in China, but across the world because of how it drives these other trends. And I think automation is a really interesting one where in the Chinese case, it could well be a trigger for decades, let's be honest, of rapid automation of a lot of industry and agriculture. And the interesting part is whether that also spills over into the rest of the world in terms of some of the productivity improvements that could bring about, some of the cost savings, some of the potential deflationary pressures that can bring to the world. And it all stems from that rapidly aging population, shrinking working age population, challenges to get enough workers.
So a lot to unpack there. Yeah. Let's pick out maybe the macro and then we can delve down into a little bit more around automation. On the macro side, obviously these trends are quite deflationary. Does mean that although inflation is high today or we perceive it to be high, the trend would maybe get back down to where we were a few years ago. Are you a believer in that? Well, maybe not in the short term, but maybe on a medium long term.
I think the demographic impact on inflation is really interesting because there's very much two arguments at play at the same time. There's one that is that aging populations mean slower growth, which is like the most simple bit of maths you can do ever. If you have a population that was growing at 1% and is now shrinking by 1% a year, then that's probably 2% plus off your potential growth rate. Lower growth equals lower inflation, pretty standard sort of stuff. But the difference is now with aging populations, and this is true in China as well, is that people are retiring or aging richer than ever before because of asset gains, because of being, particularly in the Chinese case, being the first generation who's being able to almost retire rich. And so what you've got happening is this almost silver dollar that can be spent in many parts of the world that helps to keep growth probably a little bit stronger than we might have expected typically. So aging populations needn't be quite as bad for growth as you might expect. But at the same time, you've got that shrinking working age population. And yes, some jobs can be automated and AI and automation technologies can help with some of these things and to offset that. But broadly, if you have fewer workers and you've still got some demand in the economy, well, that could push up wage growth and it could push up a little bit of cost for businesses as a result. And that could be inflationary. So the two probably cancel each other out to a degree. But I think if you're down the path of aging populations equals slower growth, I think you have to think that's probably on aggregate slightly disinflationary compared to where else you'd be. Because even if you have got people spending a little bit more money as they're aging, that's still not offsetting the sort of the same vibrancy you have in the economy from a growing working age population. So probably on sort of balance, slightly disinflationary, but not quite as bad as maybe you might have thought 5 or 10 years ago.
So again, thinking about those kind of spending patterns, so spending is much more on healthcare, hospitals, leisure, the obvious cruises, usually the ones that people think about, and pretty bad for sort of real estate and those sort of things where, you know, people are not going to need as much.
Yeah, the one that's really striking to me is education. And you think about the number of school children in the world in 2030 compared to 30, 40, 50 years previously. In many countries, it's less than half. And that's a dramatic change when you think about educational spend. You think about, there's great examples in the last few years of companies who sell stationery to school children in Japan who have gone bust because there's simply just not enough customers. And the same is going to be true across that whole spectrum of goods and services towards basically children. And that's a collapsing market. As I said, if you've got an addressable market that's falling by 3% a year, like we're seeing with birth rates, that's a huge challenge for a lot of businesses and a lot of areas of spending. But the areas where you are seeing clearly much more demand is on that leisure side. And there's twofold. One is that aging population. And the second is people are choosing to have children later or fewer children. And so they've got more money to spend. Mm. And you're seeing this really clearly in some of the data on travel spend. And one area that always comes up is pets. And people are buying more pets and spending more money on pets. And if you look at some of the data in the US, you can see a big divide between share of spending of expenditure on pets, depending on the household size. And people who with households of two people spend disproportionately more on pets than households with more people, i.e. households with children. So there's little pockets of the economy that should do well. But housing's a really interesting one because for me, in the short term, we have this enormous housing shortage in much of the world, which is what's almost causing these low birth rates, because you have this housing shortage that then makes it really, really difficult because people can't afford to get on the housing ladder. They can't afford to raise a family. Like we were saying about China, it's too expensive. But then at the same time, you've got this shrinking population further down the line, fewer people in 15, 20 years' time who are going to want to buy a house or be able to buy a house. So then house prices should fall. But because everyone knows that's going to happen, no one wants to build the homes. So you almost got into this almost vicious cycle at the moment where this almost demographic forecast is lowering investment. It's lowering the sort of construction in many economies because you're thinking about the future value or future demand for housing. And that in itself is making the problem worse because then people can't afford to get on the housing ladder, people are having fewer children, and that's accelerating the decline in birth rates in many parts of the world.
And I guess the shortage of housing is, you know, where you build them, right? Because obviously migration into the bigger cities for older people is pretty key, whereas they'll probably leave the rural areas, and we see that in Japan. In parts of Italy, the obvious ones where, you know, prices outside of Tokyo, you know, if you're 50, 100 miles outside of Tokyo are basically worthless, and they even give you tax incentives to move there. And, you know, there's lots of talk of buying Italian villas for the €1.
That's it. It's an enormous challenge because when you think about where people live as they age, it's a really interesting sort of life cycle. So it doesn't matter where anyone lives. Typically, when people age into their 20s or 30s, they move aggressively into cities. Like very quickly, you see sort of migration flows in the census data across the world. So it's a huge flow into cities. But the exodus is really, really slow. Now, people don't often move out of cities as much when they age. They want to stay close to amenities. If you don't want to be reliant on questionable public transport or needing to drive when you're in your 70s or 80s, you want to live near stuff. And actually, it's those sort of towns and places, like towns with stuff that are a little bit more walkable, probably do quite well out of this, actually, because they're places where people want to live when you're 70. You probably don't want to live in the centre of London. You know, no one wants to live in Soho when they're 70, but you might do when you're 20. And that's sort of, you want to live in somewhere where you've got a little bit of countryside or you've got these amenities on your doorstep. Whereas then the challenge comes for really rural areas, which really do suffer, like you say, in some of these countries from this population decline. And there's going to be a challenge for these areas to how to attract people as well. Because if you've got your population that's there today, is essentially dying out, how do you attract people to move to these areas fresh? And something we've written about in the last few years is actually this is somewhere where remote working, hybrid working could be really powerful actually for supporting not just some of those equalization of migration flows across the world and across within geographies or across the world, trying to, if, as you say, if you can pick up a villa in Italy for a euro, but you can do your job from there, well, what a fantastic quality of life, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
And that's something that wasn't possible 3 or 4 years ago. So it can actually help to offset some of those factors. And while we're on the topic, remote work could actually be one of the things that helps to tackle some of the fertility crisis sort of side of things. Because one of the reasons that young people can't afford to have children is childcare is far too expensive. There's not enough provision of childcare, or childcare is far too expensive. So people either can't justify the cost, or you get this sort of odd math situation where you either, one of your parents has to go back to work so you can get a mortgage, but then you have to pay for the childcare and it's not worthwhile. So actually remote work, flexible work can play a big role in cutting those costs too. So it's sort of interesting how demographics ripples into so many other big themes across the global economy. And this is just another one of them.
Yeah, I remember Dick Hawkinson, who is one of the first authors suddenly I read around demographics and population. One of the stats that he always used to quote, which I found really fascinating, was that lower interest rates actually led to bigger or better birth rates because of the affordability. So, if you have a couple, one could stay at home, look after the children because the mortgage rate was so low. And likewise, if interest rates were very high, divorce rates were very high as well, because the pressures that you would put on the family because of financial pressure you would put on the family, as a result, there was a lot more divorces. And so I think there's one stat that I think divorce rates are much higher in regimes where Western regimes, obviously quite different for other Asian countries and so on and so forth, but Western regimes where the higher the interest rate, the bigger the divorce rate, and less children. So
it makes complete sense. And it's something you're seeing in the data right now to an extent, because we've seen this massive collapse in birth rates since the pandemic. Some of it is just an acceleration of pre-existing trend, but a lot of it is just affordability. And if you're a young person, be that in China or the UK or the US or wherever at the moment, if you're in your 20s, the notion of starting a family just feels so financially out of reach. When you think about how incomes have progressed relative to the cost of living for that generation, left further and further behind every year, in a world where house prices are getting further and further away from you every year. And it's not to say you need to buy a house to have children, but a lot of people will want to have a settled life. They'll want to say, I live here, this is where my kids can go to school, not the risk of being kicked out of your home at 2 months, 3 months notice. These are important things. And so if you've got a situation where not only is the cost of housing well out of the equation because of high interest rates and where house prices have got to, but your other day-to-day costs have gone up and you can't save that deposit, you can't even comprehend, or hang on, can't feed the two of us. What, how are we going to feed a third person? How are we going to pay for childcare? How are we going to pay for nursery? All of these things, it just delays and delays and delays. And I think this is playing such a massive role in what we're seeing in global demographics at the moment. And we're going through the last 2 to 3 years has been by far and away the biggest change in global populations we've ever seen. Now, birth rates dropped last year, probably by about 4% globally. And that is just extraordinary. And no one thought those sorts of numbers were possible. And we're still waiting on some numbers in many parts of the world, but China's birth rate fell by nearly 6%. Germany's down by, I think it's about 6 or 7% in the end. In the US, you're talking about maybe 2%, but still these numbers are huge. And I think that's all of these things are chipping in to play a role in that. And this is why demographics is so important, because the biggest change ever is happening right now. And this is going to have reverberations through the global economy for the next 25 years.
So one stat you told me a little bit earlier was around India, which, to be honest, even like surprised me.
Yeah. Well, this is it. These dropping birth rates aren't just happening in the West. They're happening everywhere. And in many emerging markets, you're seeing birth rates come down really quickly for good reasons. It's because healthcare is better. People don't need to have 4 or 5 children because of high infant mortality rates. And that's been a really, really good thing. A And also on top of that, you've had massive improvements in urbanization rates, living standards, more women in the workforce in many emerging market economies, all these structural factors that pulled down birth rates in the West over the last 30 or 40 years, they're playing a role in many emerging markets. So India is a great example of this, where now the birth rate is below that 2.1 level. It's about 1.8. We're still waiting for some final data for 2023. But you're talking about a number now where India's, the number of babies being born in India is below the replacement rate. So if life expectancy wasn't going up in India, India's population would start shrinking right now. And that is a big turn when you start thinking about the world's population. This is the world's most populous economy whose birth rate's already down there. And it's probably going to keep dropping. And it's going to drop because combination of more urbanization, people getting richer. But also India's got a potential fertility crisis. And it's something that's starting to become more and more discussed in countries across the world, thinking about actually what's happening to fertility of men and women in a world where diets are getting less healthy. Pollution is a big part of this as well. And India appears to be an economy that's right at the heart of this, of seeing this sort of in real time of those two things changing quite quickly in India in the last 15, 20 years and having a material impact on fertility levels of people. And so actually this matters. And so what you're going to see in the coming years in somewhere like India is it's more likely that birth rate keeps coming down. And if the global birth rate is already, because of that India story, below the replacement rate, so in 2023 or 2024, it's very close on the borderline, the world's birth rate is probably going to be below that replacement rate. We have to start seriously thinking about a world's population that starts shrinking in the 2040s. Now, that sounds in many ways like it's a long way away, but we're talking within 20 years, the world's population could start shrinking. And that's a number or a stat, I think, that a lot of people don't quite get their heads around, because we always think the world's population is going to keep growing, and the UN's assumptions assume the world population keeps growing to the end of this century, or maybe peaks in the 2080s if it does. But really, I think there's a pretty good chance the world's population starts shrinking much, much sooner because of this dropping birth rate, not just in the West, but in emerging economies too.
So what does this mean for, say, certain countries who need to attract population, for example? You know, one of the key differences, say, if I take the US, you know, pretty big place. We could even talk about Australia. Very big place, very good standard of living in general. They want to attract the best talent around the world. What should countries be doing to try and attract talent to come to their country in a world where we have, you know, declining or flatlining of population?
It's a good question, because I think in the years to come, migration is going to play a much, much bigger role in overall population growth and population shape in pretty much every Western economy. And it becomes a really, really serious policy decision now, both in terms of attracting people, but also making sure that when people arrive in your country, you can get them integrated into the population. I think that is going to be a huge challenge for governments across the world. Can we make sure people integrate into the workforce? We've got the right skills coming into our population so we can find jobs for people easily. Have we got people integrated socially, which is a really, really important part of this, be that language skills, be that social skills, be that mixing with people from different cultures within the economy. That's all going to be really, really important. But I think one of the big challenges here for a lot of these Western economies is you're now almost going to be competing with each other for people. And that's something we hadn't really thought about before. But actually, if you're a Western economy whose health service is going to be needed more in the coming years because you're aging population, well, if you're looking to bring doctors in from across the world, well, that's now a competitive market. And that's now something you have to think seriously. How do we target those people with good pay? How do we target those people with making it easier to get into the country with easier visa restrictions, or be that in terms of housing or getting people into the labor force very quickly? And it's a challenge, because the best example of this for years and years and years globally was Sweden. Sweden, for a long time, if you looked at the sort of international measures of how open they were to migration, how appealing they were to people moving, Sweden was top by a considerable distance, very, very open migration policy. And it worked very well economically in terms of bringing people in, but Sweden really struggled socially. How can we integrate people into society? And they've rolled back quite a lot of their sort of open immigration policy and tried to tighten up. Whereas what you're seeing happen in the sort of aftermath of the pandemic is in many other developed economies is an opening up of migration policy. You can see this in the migration numbers into Australia or Canada or the US or the UK over the course of the last year. because these countries are realizing, hang on, we need workers. We've got a shrinking working age population, rapidly aging population. People are retiring early. This is making the aging population worse for the sort of the demographics of your sort of workforce. So we need to get people quickly. And that opening up of borders, trying to think about making your country easy to move to integrate, to get a job, is going to be a much, much bigger part of government policy in the years to come, almost despite the rhetoric that a lot of governments are spinning around immigration at the moment.
Yeah, it just seems to be a very, very hot potato topic. I remember reading in the Financial Times, I think it was maybe 6 months, maybe a year ago now, but about a Japanese nurse who decided to move to Australia because she was getting better pay.
Yeah,
which I found, you know, was for me was very symptomatic of the challenge. Obviously, it's probably because the yen was so weak, but it was very symptomatic of the challenge that if you're a Japanese nurse, you should be the most prized person in the population, given the aging population, but they still can't keep them.
Yeah.
I found that actually really quite fascinating in terms of an indicator of how things have changed.
Definitely. And some of these countries, you can see Australia is a great example of this. They're doing a really good job of picking up skilled people from across the world by offering high wages. And it's that wage story that's going to become really, really interesting in the years to come. And it's an important question. We're here in the UK where the NHS is permanently struggling to get staff. Mm. And you've got NHS workers who regularly are in the news saying they're moving to Australia for the same reasons, because you get better pay and better working conditions and all of these things. And that's going to be something that you're going to get this huge amount of competition for. It's just like an extreme version of any tight labour market. Mostly across the world today, you've got companies bidding, well, in the height of the sort of tight labour market in 2022, you had basically any company bending over backwards for workers to keep them. And you've got the same thing now happening on the global scale for people who've got skills that we have a massive shortage of. And globally, there's a shortage of healthcare professionals and there's a growing demand for them because of the ageing population. I think it's going to be a really interesting part of national government policy in the years to come, how we can make sure, well, how different governments can make sure they're attracting the workers who can make the health systems, which are going to be under more and more pressure, and function effectively. And that could mean actually higher wages in those key sectors.
Yeah, certainly I noticed a stat I saw the other day, something for the UK NHS, is how many Filipino nurses have been coming over here, and they speak good English, you know, can integrate much more easily into society and work really hard.
That's it. It's going to be, and this is where I think you're going to get that change happening, is it becomes, you almost go, that migration happens from different places. So the UK is a great example of this, where migration flows before Brexit were disproportionately from the EU into the UK. And since Brexit, actually, the UK's migration has shifted massively to be sort of non-EU migration. And it's because actually, if you're moving from the Philippines to the UK, that uplift in terms of wages is absolutely enormous. And so it still makes sense to do that move. And actually, what you've got on this global labour market is there is a big pool of workers, very skilled, more skilled than ever before, coming from these emerging markets that do still have fast-growing populations like the Philippines, like Indonesia, like India, Bangladesh, these large countries in Asia, as well as a lot in Africa as well. And those people are going to be in demand globally now. And actually, the opportunities that's available for those people is probably good news for the world in many ways, because people then move across the world, they get a higher wage than they otherwise would have done. You get those remittances back into your local population. And that's been a huge part of the Filipino, basically almost economic model for years and years moving to the US and sending money back. And it's something that will only increase in the coming years as the need for that global migration increases because of the massive moves we're seeing in populations.
So think a little bit more about what countries could do. A strategy you alluded to earlier was around automation, and I guess robotics is the other one. Mm. I saw a Tesla robot the other day, and I was just thinking to myself, okay, you know, when I'm retired, you know, in my 70s and 80s, I'm going to get one of those. Yeah. It's going to just do everything for me.
That's it. I think there's a number of ways this is going to happen, right? There's going to be more automation and day-to-day tasks, because if you've got a older population who finds it harder to do a lot of things by yourself, be that autonomous vehicles, it's a natural acceleration for that. If people find it hard to drive when they're older and you've got a growing share of the population who's old, then there's a greater incentive for autonomous vehicles. The same is going to be true for any assistant around the home. It's going to be, how can we get more and more processes in our lives that are easy to do, that you can do at a touch of a button? And I think that wave of automation is coming, but in the sort of personal space because of that aging population. But at the same time, there's going to be this massive wave of automation that happens on the sort of business side of things. And it's happening for a number of reasons. One is because the tightness of the labor market over the last couple of years. But if you think this is structural and you think actually what's happened is you've got an aging population who's retiring early, because I mentioned earlier, people now in their 50s and 60s, by and large, are richer than ever before. And so you're seeing a lot of early retirements, and that early retirements are taking very skilled people out of the workforce. It's meaning businesses all over the world at the moment are struggling to find not just workers, but skilled workers. And it certainly makes you think differently about that automation decision. Actually, yeah, we could get some workers, or we could automate some processes, but why would we now not do that automation? It's a much easier decision to make than ever before because of that change on the labor sort of supply side of things. And those workers you can get are very expensive, so it makes it cheaper to justify that automation. The robotics and the automation is getting better and better and spreading across more industries. So I think there's a pretty good chance we're entering a golden age for automation. And everyone talks about AI in the world at the moment, but that more boring, in quotes, sort of automation, I think this is the golden age for it. And we've written plenty in the last couple of years saying that, you know, in this next decade, this is the time. You know, pre-pandemic, people would joke, is a robot going to take my job, as sort of a worry? Or do you see all these articles all over the place? And actually now what we want is more robots to take more people's jobs. We almost need that to happen now. And I think that's the thing that's changed enormously.
So I guess we covered a huge amount of ground far, far quicker than I ever imagined. So moving then in terms of some of the, I guess, second order deflationary impacts, where do you see kind of the biggest issues around some of these deflationary forces? Is it, you know, Germany, Italy, obvious ones in Europe? Even Spain and Portugal are also falling into that trap as well.
I think it's an interesting one because there's a lot of examples globally that stand out right now. And we've spoken about Japan, we've spoken about China. You mentioned in Europe just there, there's a number of countries with very low birth rates in Italy and Spain, with birth rates not too dissimilar to China. It's amazing how little less attention they get than China. But the number one globally by a long way is South Korea. The birth rate is now so low, 0.7 children per woman, less than that in Seoul. You're talking about a population there that drops by two thirds over the course of a generation. Now, that is just terrifying numbers. And you start thinking, okay, what does that do to South Korea on the global stage? What does it do to everything within that economy? It just completely changes the entire fabric of how you think about South Korea as a country when you've got a birth rate that low. But these are the examples today. And something that I think goes sort of under the radar a little bit with demographics is all the things that are causing those low birth rates in Korea or in China, Japan, or in Italy or Spain, or you name it, they're happening everywhere. They're happening in the UK. They're happening in the US. They're even, to a degree, happening in Scandinavia. You know, Sweden has most famously one of the most generous paternity policies in the world, according to the OECD. It spends the most in terms of government spending on family support. Sweden's birth rate fell by about 7% last year. So it's happening sort of across the board. And so what we're sort of getting at is it's easy now to worry about demographics globally through these handful of extreme examples. But take the UK. The birth rate in the UK is about 1.4, 1.5 children per woman. It's dropping by 3% a year at the moment. And nothing, the stuff that's causing that to happen, none of that is changing. No, there's no government policy that's making housing more affordable for young people. There's no changes to make it cheaper for people to raise a family with childcare costs or any of those things. Cost of living is not going to get any better for those people. The social changes that are driving lower birth rates are continuing, be that more female participation in the workforce, be that concerns about climate change or geopolitics, or the reasons that people report as not wanting to have as many kids. People are having kids later. That's not going to change. And so you put all that together and you go, well, why does that 2 or 3, 4% drop in birth rates not continue? And then if it keeps continuing, by the time we're in 10 years' time, 15 years' time, the UK's birth rate is like Korea's. And that's not just the UK. I'm not just picking out the UK. It's true for all these developed economies. And the UK's birth rate today is lower than Japan's was at the start of the 1990s. And the evidence suggests we're on a faster path towards a Korea than I think a lot of people imagine. So it's very much these isolated issues globally today in these extreme examples. But the declines we're seeing, I think it's a situation we're going to have to wake up to really, really seriously in many, many Western economies. And if you take somewhere like the UK or the US, you could see birth rates drop by 2 or 3% a year for the next 20 years. It's not out of the question unless something dramatically changes on policy. And then you're talking about the population of those economies halving by the time you get to the end of this century. And that's a discussion I think a lot of economists and demographers are afraid to have because it sounds terrifying. Mm. But this is the path we're on. If nothing changes, if the world's population keeps changing how it's been changing for the last 5 years, the world's population will be half of what it is today by the end of this century. Mm. And we probably won't be that extreme. Birth rates won't drop that quickly. We will see some bottoming out. Policy will step in, or housing will become more affordable, or social changes will happen. But this is the path we're on. And that is terrifying, really, when you think about what that does to everything in the global economy. It's good news in some ways. Some people will listen to this and be like, this sounds fantastic. You know, all those worries about climate change.
Change disappear. Yeah, I was going
to
say that.
No one's going to worry about climate change. There'll be no traffic. I'll be able to get a house. It'll be fine. All these things, like shrinking populations, can be fantastic on a micro level. Don't get me wrong. There's some enormous upsides of this. The challenge is, if you're a government sat on 100% of GDP in debt or more, and you're faced with that impending demographic collapse and a rapidly aging population, then it's something you can't ignore. And even in those economies, like the UK or the US or developed economies as a whole, you're already talking about a situation we've got about 15% of the population's over the age of 65. By the time we get to 2050, that's going to be 30%, 35% in some countries. And that's on a favorable demographic outlook. So suddenly you start thinking, wow, what happens if it's legitimately possible by 2050 that 40% of people in many developed economies are over the age of 65? That is almost impossible to run an economy unless you make some really, really serious changes to how the country works. And that, I think, is something a lot of policymakers are terrified of confronting.
Yeah, well, I think the other issue is because they have, you know, overall debt to GDP, you know, levels are pretty high up there. Exactly, for a lot of these countries, and presumably, you know, that is going to be fairly deflationary as well at some point. And yeah, unfortunately, it's going to be the people who are going to need it most are going to suffer the most.
That's it. You look, if you're a government across the world right now, you look at these numbers, you look at your 100% of GDP in debt, let's say the US or the UK, or many economies have a similar level of debt today. And you look, you plug in some demographic projections for the rest of the century, and those numbers look like they're going to 300%.
Yeah.
And you're suddenly like, well, what do you do? What can you do about that? Yeah. And you suddenly face this question of, there's almost no policy change you can make that properly offsets that demographic change, unless you're really, really willing to go big bang with some policy changes. And so we live in a world where debt levels just stay high, keep rising. And as you say, that has massive implications for bond markets, for growth potential, for how governments choose to spend money, where you see investment. It ripples through to almost every single part of the global economy. And it's all driven by how bad that demographic situation is getting.
Well, I think it's quite interesting because when you look at Japan or Korea, there were countries that actually had a lot of net foreign assets. So, you know, Japan, even if you adjust for that, or its local debt, still looks like it's in a pretty healthy position, as does Korea.
Yeah.
So it's quite interesting, those countries are a bit of an outlier relative to everywhere else.
Yeah, that's the difference. If you've got assets, debt becomes slightly less problematic. But if you don't have any assets, those debt levels become really problematic. Yeah. And when you look at some of the debt to sort of assets ratio, or you sort of bring assets into the equation in many parts of the world, well, actually, some of those numbers don't look quite as terrifying, yeah, other than in the UK.
Yeah, that's right. I was going to say.
And that's one that looks particularly worrying when you take that into account.
No, absolutely. The UK does look in a much more precarious position than many other countries on that basis. Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. So let's talk a little bit about some of the solutions. Again, you alluded to what the solutions are. They're going to be policy solutions, ultimately. Japan, for example, you know, immigration was a big thing. Immigration has picked up compared to zero as it was before, yeah, but probably not fast enough. Yeah. But I guess immigration is certainly one we talked about. What other policy measures can we? I have another theory on social media as well.
Okay.
You know, and one of the big downsides of COVID and maybe one of the things we have is that we've seen people not coming to the office. You know, yeah. if you think about, you know, broadly in any sort of working population, I know 1/3, 1/4 of all relationships started in an office. Yeah. And now people don't go to an office. It's yeah. just, you know, that sort of compounds a problem. Yeah. But yeah, anyway, solutions.
No, it's fantastic. There's a number of stats like that that have come out in the last few years, like this huge drop in marriages, number of people going on dates. Of course, the pandemic was terrible for this. Yeah, last thing you wanted to do in the height of a global pandemic was meet up with a stranger. Yeah, so you suddenly had this sort of almost like one-off sort of drops in some of these things. And as you say, some of this is being compounded, like closing down of nightlife venues. So fewer people going to nightclubs, fewer people going to bars, all of those things has an impact, as well as you say, fewer people meeting in offices. So I think governments have got a sort of a menu of things they can think about. The obvious one is, how can we encourage people to have more children? History tells you that's really, really hard. No country in history has really had a successful way of saying to people, "Oh, how about you have more children?" It's just not going to work, because you're fighting against massive structural, economic and social forces. You can make it easier, and that means making the cost of having children not quite as bad. That can be either in terms of the spending that's done in terms of childcare support, in terms of paternity pay, maternity pay, those sorts of things. And just as an example, Sweden is, as I said, the best in the world on this. It spends about 4.5% of GDP on family support policies. The OECD average is closer to 3%. So there's a lot of countries can do. But in Sweden, the birth rate's held up. It's dropped in the last couple of years, but it's held up much higher than other developed economies. So it does suggest that plays a role, but you're probably talking 0.1, 0.2 on your birth rate from that amount of spending. The broader thing is, it's just too expensive. So you need to seriously cut the cost of childcare. Now, the UK government's tried this, making it easier for people to get childcare when their children are born, all the way through to school age, but there's just not enough supply. There's just not enough people working in this industry. So you need to pay, you need to invest money into these sectors so that more people can get access to cheap or free childcare. That's a big part of it. I think make a huge difference. We need to build more homes. We need to make cost of buying a home much, much cheaper for young people. You need to incentivize people financially to do so and to have children, so that you start changing some of that mindset towards having kids. But there's no guarantee any of this works, which is why governments are reluctant to spend a lot of money on it. And even if it does work, the benefits to society are seen 20 years down the line. So one, the incentives to do it politically aren't really there. And secondly, you don't know if it's going to work. So it's quite a difficult one. So if you don't think that's going to work, or you don't go down the fertility side, you either go down the migration side, which we talked about a lot, and you probably need to start thinking about how you can attract people into your country. But the other one is, you go down, you tackle the challenge, and you have to think seriously about what you do with this. And this is where you get into the really seriously unpopular stuff. You either take the retirement age much, much higher. And this is my sort of manifesto list. This is why I'm never, ever going to be elected, because you take the retirement age in most developed economies. It was set in the post-Second World War, when life expectancy was 65 to 70. Mm. You set retirement age at 65. Mm. Well, that's a 2 to 3 year gap, say 67, 68 life expectancy. Well, life expectancy in most developed economies is now well into your 80s, like closer to 90 in many economies. So to keep that same gap, same fiscal cost of someone in your economy as being a pensioner, retirement ages need to be in their mid 80s. And I mean, that's just not going to happen overnight, but there's going to have to be a serious discussion about taking pension ages into the 70s. Yeah. And it's going to have to happen eventually. And the longer you leave it, the higher that jump has to be. And that's the problem. It's enormous to make that decision.
Yeah, and that's like an exponential impact, right? If you don't, the later you start, the more trouble it's going to cause in the future.
That's it. And no one does it because it's such a...
unpopular.
So unpopular. And it gets disproportionately unpopular as well, because your population's aging. If we were to find someone who's 20 today, just entered the workforce, you said to them, you know what, you're not going to retire at 68, you're going to retire at 78. They'd be like, who cares? It's a rounding error. If you pick up someone who's 65 and you go, you know what, we're pushing it back 10 years, suddenly you get into a little bit more unpopular. And so that skew in the population matters as well. And then you get into, so you could do that, but hugely unpopular, it's got to be done. You either go down the path of making life worse for retiring. So you think seriously about how you're going to fund pensions. Should pensions be less generous. And again, that's a brutal thing to do, but something's got to give. And that's a challenging thing for governments to do. And again, for the same political reason, or you think seriously about funding your health service, because that's one of the biggest costs. Basically, aging populations push up costs for pensions and health and a number of other things, but they're mostly on those two. And that healthcare expense goes up massively with an aging population. People over the age of 65 draw on the health service multiples times people much, much younger. And so there has to be serious discussion about how you fund that. Should you start thinking seriously about privatization of health services, or how you fund sort of pay at the point of use, or however it needs to be done? But it's got to change in many economies, that the model of sort of free at the point of consumption healthcare becomes very, very difficult to keep up economically. Or you go for the third option, you just tax people more. And no more popular, but realistically, you've got to go down one of those three, if not all three, in one way or another, going forwards. But could you imagine if I turned up for the next election here in the UK, stood as an MP and said, guys, I've got three flagship policies. I'm going to take your tax rates 10 percentage points high. I'm going to raise your retirement age by 7 or 8 years, and I'm going to make the NHS worse. I'm not sure anyone would vote for.
Yeah, I'm pretty certain of that. Yeah. Well, but I think it goes back down to the competitive policy, right? You know, yeah. I think virtually everyone, you know, I probably didn't know anyone who moved to Dubai or any of those kind of tax-free economies. Yeah. Now you pretty much bump into someone every day who's either knows somebody or is thinking about doing it themselves. But I guess it plays into that whole sort of demographic challenge around sort of tax and healthcare, even though healthcare is very, very expensive, but still.
Yeah, it certainly does. And it also, this global movement of people then makes a big difference for other economies, right? If you think about Western European economies, which for years have been beneficiaries from the demographic side of things of Eastern Europeans moving into countries. Yeah. And that's almost like the perfect migration, because you get people move in as working age, they work, and they typically retire back in their home country. Yeah. And now basically we're getting the opposite, but with Middle Eastern economies. So you're getting people, the British state or French or German pays for education, people go and work out somewhere else, and they come back and retire. And that actually becomes a double fiscal challenge, because you're not getting the tax revenues whilst people are working, but you've got to pay the support at either end. And that's been a huge challenge in somewhere like Poland for years and years and years. And it's something we could start to see creeping into some of the demographics and the fiscal impact in other Western European economies now.
Yeah. So moving then on to like a final summaries here, we obviously talked about the macro, some of the policy changes need to, just going back into a little bit more of the micro stuff. So we talked about pets, we talked about automation, we talked about, I guess, AI, autonomous driving, all of those robotics, all those sort of things that are going to help old age be easier, more self-sufficient is probably the right word. What other things can you see? Leisure, we talked about, and cruises. What other things can you see other than those?
It's a difficult one because, say, this touches almost every single aspect of the global economy. You're thinking about, okay, what do people choose to spend their money on when they got more free time and more spare money? And in some ways, you've had some pretty good ready reckoners on that over the last few years with the pandemic. People had money and time. Well, what did we choose to spend our money on? Well, we sort of frivolously spent it on a load of like durable goods that no one turns out they really needed. But you could basically see that play out to slightly more extremity in the coming years. Essentially, it's that discretionary spend is probably slightly higher from older generations. And we know that's going to go in some areas on the good side of the economy. It could be more automated processes, but that leisure story, just almost essentially every single theme I think about in the global economy takes me back towards people wanting to spend more money and time on leisure. And be that because of this aging population who now have more money in the bank and able to go and spend it, or be it because people are having fewer children and they've got more money to go and spend. And that matters massively. So if you think about a couple in their 30s, if you don't have kids or you have kids, if you don't have kids, you spend less on housing, you spend less on childcare, you spend less on everything else that comes with that, but your income is probably higher as well. Mm. And so actually you are much, much richer than if you'd had two kids. And that, where do people spend money when they've got extra money? They spend it on travel and leisure and those sides of the economy. And it's no surprise to me that actually this declining birth rate is being seen alongside these booms in these sectors. And I think that can become quite structural as we see and that declining birth rate. And they say people spend on leisure and they also spend their money on pets and see that as a nicer, easier option than having children.
Than having children, yeah. Well, James, thank you very much. That was very fascinating. Lots of takeaways there for our listeners. So again, appreciate your time for coming in. Thank you, and hopefully see you again soon.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks. So that wraps us up for today on Beyond the Benchmark. My name is Mo Zafzal, Chief Investment Officer for EFG, and you've been listening to the podcast Beyond the Benchmark. Thank you very much.